Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program information and to reserve tickets. I'm Michael Krasny, host of KQED Radio's Forum and your moderator for tonight's program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Rita Moreno, legendary performer, one of the select group of artists who have received an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony, and author of the new book, Rita Moreno, A Memoir. And my notes tell me that they'd like me to give less than 1 minute intro in my own words, so let me say this. Aside from being a sensational performer whom many of you have followed through the years and certainly admired as I have, who can sing and dance exceptionally and inimitably and also act in an extraordinary way. I'm glad to say that she is a friend, and I use that sacred word not even advisedly. I have 5,000 Facebook friends and very few people that I would actually call friends. Rita, I'm delighted and honored to say, is one of them. And she is not only a good and loyal friend, she is a remarkable and very dedicated, genuine human being. I happened to speak recently to Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who we're both friends with, and she was just extolling Rita's generosity. It comes across, as does her vitality, as does her spirit. So without any further words from me, please welcome Rita Moreno.
You don't want the applause to stop before you sit down. When you get an Oscar, you don't want the applause to die down before you get on stage. It's the rule.
Well, it certainly hasn't died down for you. I could also say, by way of introduction, you are the youngest octogenarian I know, because you are. And how many of you actually saw Rita perform her one-woman show at the Berklee Repertory Theater? Yeah.
12. And I know what that is. It's that damn bridge. Wow.
Well, there you did what you do in your book. You brought it all alive on stage, however. And I can remember many things from that program, particularly your dancing. And I want to take you back before we come up to the present. I want to find out, and this is going to sound maybe a little loopy Northern California, but when you write your memoir and when you think about that young girl who came here from Puerto Rico at age 5 and took dancing lessons, probably never would have expected to be on the cover of Life magazine and dating Marlon Brando and Elvis Presley and winning an Oscar, et cetera, et cetera. Who was that little girl? Can you sort of recapture for us what you were looking toward at that stage of your life or what you were hoping you would be?
Well, my mama brought me to the United States, which in that time, particularly for Puerto Ricans, was New York City. And we came by boat because we couldn't afford an airplane. We were quite poor. And that little girl that you're asking me to describe was this happy child, who loved her childhood up to then. I believe I was about 5 when I arrived in this country. And I didn't understand why she would bring me to this place that was freezing and gray and ashy looking. You couldn't even see people's faces because they were wearing scarves. They were so cold. And pretty quickly, and I remember thinking, this is crazy. Why is my mommy doing this? And, well, she obviously wanted a better life for both of us. She got a divorce from my papi when just before she brought me to this country. Oh, I have laryngitis, so forgive me if my voice breaks. Actually, I think it's kind of charming. It's very Jean. What's her name? Who is the lady with the wonderful voice, the wonderful actress?
With laryngitis?
Well, it sounded that way. Who was that? Jean? Huh?
I don't think so.
Never mind. I just thought it was charming. Anyway.
Should I say what a trooper you were singing in Napa with that laryngitis?
I did a concert. on Sunday night at Napa Valley Opera House, because I helped to open it when it reopened. And so they asked me if I would come back on their 10th anniversary. And it was really bad then. My voice was really, really bad then. So I did my opening number, and immediately I had to tell people, you know, I have this problem. So I just said, I have this problem. I have laryngitis. And my voice was really breaking all over the place. And I said, but the bad news is that I'm going to sing anyway. They loved that. And that's what I did. It's what you do. The show must go on, blah, blah. Where was I? Puerto Rico? New York?
We were having you come as a young...
When you're 81, you know, you are rather scattered, or at least I am.
Yeah, the young girl, seeing America in its ashen... the picture that you painted for us was certainly a darker one, but it was of a happy, almost euphoric young girl.
I had a great, very early childhood in Puerto Rico, and I was living in paradise, and as I say in the book, it sort of turned to a reverse Oz when I came to this country. I was really shocked and saddened. And not understanding why my mother would even think of doing this. I had a little brother back in Puerto Rico, Francisco, Frank, whom I never saw again, ever. And we can that gets explained in the book, sort of, because it's still a bit of a mystery to me. But what really turned me around when I came to this country, and I was really very, very young, was being called bad names by the kids in the neighborhood. And you know, when you're a very young person, 5, 6, 7, you're ultra tender. You really should be treated like a little butterfly up until a certain age, I think. And being called spick and greaseball, I'm talking about being 5, 6, and 7. And all of these dreadful names, I didn't understand at first what those words meant because I didn't speak English, but I understood what I saw in the faces of those young kids. So when you ask me what was it like for me then, it was a mystery and it was miserable. And I knew that I couldn't tell my mommy because she would get upset and there was nothing she could do about it. So I grew up wanting to be anybody but me. And that's, in a way, the thrust of the book. This child who grows into a young woman who just wants desperately to be Elizabeth Taylor because that's safe. And that also suggests success. And it's that journey that I wanted to share with people because I haven't seen a book like that about someone in my business who had that kind of experience. That's essentially one of the most important goals in my book. The other was being in a marriage that, I just give long answers, don't I? No, go ahead. I mean, I could go on and on.
This I'm actually struck by what you say about not wanting to be yourself, because certainly that is a great outlet for anybody who wants to be an actor or to be a thespian or to have different roles, and you've had such a range. Most people think it all began for you with that winning of an Oscar, but there was a career long. You were kind of a child prodigy in terms of dancing. You're on cover of Life magazine as a young girl and so forth. But the fact of the matter is, in many ways, you were developing not only ability as a dancer, but as an actress and as a singer.
I was also developing calluses to take all those terrible falls.
Well, I mean, it was kind of a miraculous story because they all came together. They all really merged in many respects.
Yeah.
And that's unusual. I mean, people usually go in one trajectory. They go toward acting or they go toward maybe singing and dancing and so forth. But for you, it's always been, and still is,
everything.
Really, the three of those.
Yeah. It's true. But you know what? In my time, you didn't do just one thing. And if you remember the old MGM movies, which was the studio of my dreams, when I went there under contract, you had to do everything. So I learned, I was a Spanish dancer initially. Then I became a tap dancer, and I did ballet classes. And then I learned to sing. And then I learned to act on radio, the Ave Maria Hour. But I'm telling you, I see that lady in the grotto. The blue lady in the grotto. Get that child out of here. She's mad. So I had to do all kinds of, I didn't have to, but you did. You danced. Van Johnson in the movies in that time learned to dance because he was under contract to MGM. Everybody at MGM, even Clark Gable did a musical number in an MGM movie. Mm-hmm. So you just, that's what you did then. Now everybody specializes. It's like law and medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, I sing. Oh, I dance. I'm an actor.
You're always asked probably, which do you love more? Which do you feel more passionate about? Impossible question to answer?
No. I love to act. But you know, when I sing, I inevitably will find songs to sing in my cabaret show or concerts that I do. I will inevitably choose songs that are actable. So that when I played Norman Desmond in London at the theater. I actually replaced a woman who was doing it forever and ever, and she needed a break, and I went in for 3 months. And that's my kind of meat, because I can become someone. I love becoming someone. So it's really, ultimately, it's about acting. And when I sing songs, I will more often than not pick songs where I can be somebody that I'm not, that I can pretend to be. I love that. Oh, I love that.
But here's the irony, you know, to me, is that you speak about these early, somewhat traumatic experiences being called spick and names like that, opprobrious names. And then you've got really the high point where you win an Oscar and get this amazing recognition. We might talk about that, what you said, actually, when you received the Oscar. But then there was a real fallow period where suddenly you were being consigned to all these sort of stereotypical Hispanic roles, or Native American or that sort of thing, just women of color, you know,
well,
but stereotypical.
Well, I call them dusky maidens. And I played lots of dusky maidens before the Oscar, actually. That's all I did in movies. And it was very depressing because ultimately they were written in such terrible stereotypical ways that the roles were really rather demeaning. But I knew that I had to be in the movies and that I wanted recognition as an actress, and I just stuck to it. Because a lot of young people say, well, why don't you just leave? Not so fast. It wasn't so easy. You want to be in the movies? You did what was allotted to you. And what was your question?
Let me get back to the Oscar. You were really shocked when you got the Oscar, weren't you?
I was shocked beyond belief. I was there because you think to yourself, well, my God, if there's this much of a chance that my name will be called, I want to be there. Because I remember Sophia Loren was up for it for a wonderful Italian film called Two Women, and she didn't show up. And by the way, she did win. And she wasn't there because she said it herself. She said, I just couldn't bear the thought of having to deal with that. And I could bear it. I thought, if there's a chance, I had no idea, none. Judy Garland was up in my category, Best Featured Actress, for a film called,
I couldn't help you with your laryngitis thing, and I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to help you here.
Maybe you should have gotten Ron Owens or something. I don't know. Just something at Nuremberg.
Judgment at Nuremberg.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So she was up for that, and I thought, oh, well, you know, it's a straight role. She's going to wipe the floor with me. But I thought, Justin, I have to be there. Because I flew in from Manila, where I was playing yet another dusky person in a thing called Battle Cry. But I flew in because I thought, you know, I had a gown made and all that. And I have to tell you, when my name was called, I was absolutely stunned. I was poleaxed. And I remember getting up. My mother was in back of me, and she grabbed me and hugged me. And I got up out of my chair in the theater, and I said to myself, don't run. Now and then, you know, I would get this interesting strength of character that I didn't always have. You'll read the book, you'll know what I mean. And I said, don't, it's what I said before, because a lot of people, particularly the women, would run in case the applause stopped before they got to the stage. And there's something, there's an energy drop that's quite serious and meaningful when that happens. And I just thought, if they stop clapping, I'm still going to walk at my pace. And it didn't stop, because West Side Story was a huge, huge success, not only with the public, but with Hollywood. We actually broke all records at that time for the most Oscars.
So let me jump ahead for a moment. How comfortable are you in your own skin now? I mean, in terms of feeling like you want to be somebody else as opposed to being Rita Moreno, who is much loved and much admired and adored.
I think I'm swell. But let me tell you something. Well, let me tell you something very interesting about having said that. There was a little girl who still lives inside me, whose name is Rosita Dolores Alverio. I mean, I give her that identity because she's a dark presence. And again, that's in part of the book. And she's the one who still says things like, I told you you couldn't do it. Ha, 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 ha. She still exists. And I maintain that that child still exists in a lot of adult people. We just don't give her a name, him or her a name. That dark presence exists in a lot of us for many, many good reasons. And I judge how much I've matured by my ability to say to her, not always, but my ability to say to that little presence who's making fun of me and doing this to me, to say to her, go to your room. To me, that is the sign of a certain maturity that I have attained. But she still gets her way sometimes. That's what's so frustrating.
But she's still that little girl that, for those of you who know the electric company, that yells out, hey, you guys! Huh?
And the electric company.
Yeah. I mean, there's still that kind
of... Oh, well, you know, I'm a person who...
Effervescence, I would
use. I am effervescent. I'm a person who still jumps up and down like a child when I'm happy about something. And, you know, I do that, and I don't do it for effect. I just do it because I'm that happy. So, yeah, but that's not Rosita Dolores Alverio. I always think of Rosita Dolores Alverio as the dark presence, this nasty little bitch.
Well, can we talk a little bit about darkness?
I think we just did.
Well, it makes me think about your relationship with Brando, which has certainly caused a lot of attention and brought you a lot of interest twice on Morning Joe and on all the talk shows and so forth, because Brando was Brando. And ironically, here you were trying to make him jealous by dating Elvis. I mean, how many women...
Well, wait. There's a reason for that. But go on.
No, but I'm just thinking, okay. How many women around in the world of entertainment can say that they had those experiences with two such extraordinary figures, to put it mildly?
I was with the two kings.
Yeah, exactly.
The king of rock and roll and the king of movies.
But it was a dark period for you with Brando, and it was actually suicidal at one point. Well,
indeed it was. First of all, I was always looking for a father, because I had five of them, you know, four stepfathers. And my idea of a man, a male, who would protect you, which is what I was always looking for, was anybody who was a lot smarter than I. I even did this with girlfriends. I always found women in my life, girlfriends, who were educated. I quit school after first year of high, so I was always after people who knew more than I, who could teach me. And Marlon was one of those. On top of everything else, it was very intoxicating to be found extremely attractive by this icon. It was intoxicating.
And my sister still talks about him in that undershirt and streetcar, and she's in her 70s.
The world does. Yeah. I'm 81, and I still think of it. So, I mean, you have to... Did I say I mean? God, I hate those qualifiers. I was thrilled that this astonishing sex god found me attractive and found me sexy and found me charming and found me delicious and found me fiery and all that kind of stuff. And what happened is that we became obsessed with each other. Now, if you know anything at all about obsession, and boy, do I know, it is a drug. He was my cocaine, and I became his. And there were so many, I'm through with you, I can't bear this anymore, and I'd leave. And then, I don't know, a month later, 2 weeks later, I'd come back. And it would happen again, and I'm leaving. Okay, that's it, that's it. And he would finally, he said to me, "Never say never, Rita," which really was just, it killed me because he was right. He knew. He knew so well that I was unable to leave him. It became a suicide attempt when I had lost every vestige of dignity and self-respect going away and coming back and going away and coming back. And one time, who knows, it might have been the 12th time that I went back to him. Notice he never said, "No, don't come back." Very important to remember that. I couldn't bear it anymore. I was a wraith. I was thin. There were huge hollows in my young face. And when he went to work that day, he was doing a mutiny on the Bounty. And I was in his house, and I said to myself, that's it. I can't do this anymore. And I went to his bathroom and took a big handful of sleeping pills.
Yeah. Well, you were quite the babe, as anybody who's seen those pictures of you.
Hey, I still am.
I didn't say you still weren't. Can you tell the story? In fact, we're talking about two kings, Brando and Elvis. There's another gentleman who is of rather regal stature in American history, who took a rather strong and proprietary interest in you. Can you tell that story?
You're going to love this. Promise. Okay. In the old days, all the big studios used to send their young people out to decorate events. And in this particular instance, it was Ann Miller and myself. And I found myself on a... Should I tell that one?
Absolutely.
Okay, it's a funny one. So there I find myself... I'm going to cut this as short as I can. I found myself on a Pan Am plane going to Palm Beach to help decorate, literally, she and I, the opening of a nightclub in a big-time Palm Beach hotel, which, by the way, still exists. It's called The Colony. And they were opening the Colony Club, the nightclub there. And there I am sitting opposite Ann Miller on this airplane, because in those days, Pan Am, the first two rows, you faced each other. And there is my hero. And I'm just staring at her. And I don't know what to say. And I finally say, "You know, I'm a dancer too." And she said, "Oh yeah?" I mean, she really was like that. She was Maisie. She really was like that. And she said, "So what kind of dancing do you do, honey?" And I said, "Well, I'm a Spanish dancer." And I said, "Well, you know, I do castanets and I do the sevillanas." And she said, "The sevillwats?" "Oh," she said, "okay, I get it. You do like these rumbas and salsas and tangos, stuff like that, right?" And I said, Yeah, kind of. Anyway, I said, "Anyway, Miss Miller, I just want you to know that I have always loved you and admired you. And I just want to know how you did all those amazing tap dances on all those platforms and steps. I mean, you did a lot of movies where you tap dance on steps. It's amazing. How did you do that?" And she looked at me and she said, "Honey, wait a minute, what's your name?" I said, "Rita." And she said, "Well, let me tell you, honey. If I have to work with one more fucking choreographer who's going to make me do a fucking dance, on a fucking flight of steps, I'm going to fucking kill him. That's in the book. But it's more fun when I tell it. And I mean, with every F-bomb, my head would just snap back. I'd never heard anybody, let alone a woman, do this. Okay, dissolve. We're now we're going to get to this famous figure. We're now in Palm Beach, and it's opening night of this nightclub at the Colony Hotel, and it's nothing but society people. Society people up the wazoo. And at one point, I'm sitting with Anne at a table before the festivities start, because they had a show. And in walks this gentleman with reddish hair and a beautiful woman. I had never seen a woman dressed like that in my whole life. She had the dress, the gown of the day. I had just seen it in Vogue magazine that day. And it was a warped rose print in satin with a very full skirt, a strapless top. And she had something on that I had never seen on a woman ever in my life. Opera gloves up to here. And she was gorgeous. And the moment this man, he had to pass Ann and me on the way to his table, which was way over there. The moment he took a look at me, the moment I got a look you wouldn't believe. It was like, and I thought, wow, he don't waste no time, this guy. So for the rest of the evening, every time I looked at his table, because it became a game for me, he would be looking at me with these searing, hot, sexual looks. I mean, they were shamelessly sexual. And I kept thinking, my God, he's got this gorgeous woman next to him, and he's giving me these signals, sending all of these signals. And I said to Anne, who is that guy over there? You know, he keeps sending me these signals. And she looked and she said, I don't know, honey. All I know is that they're rich. I simply want to tell you, and this went on all night, it got to the point where I got playful, and every time I'd look at him and he was looking at me already, I'd go, like, caught you? He didn't crack a smile. But I want to tell you right here and now that had I given him even the tiniest sign that I was interested, you can bet that someone would have come to my table and escorted me out of the nightclub and taking me up to a room in this very fancy hotel. 2 weeks later, I had a roommate, Phyllis, and I get Life magazine, and I see him on the cover of Life. And I went, Phyllis, this is the guy. This is the guy I was telling you that story about. And it said, the new young senator, John F. Kennedy. Oh. So it's true. All of it is true.
Well, he was known for his quickness and consummation, so I don't know how much you missed. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is star of stage and screen, and now author Rita Moreno. And you can also find the video of the Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Let's go to some questions from the audience. Which was the hardest to win, Oscar, Emmy, Grammy, or Tony?
Gee, it's not a question of hard. To be recognized is astonishing, and that's what was so amazing about having gotten the Oscar. It's not a question hard to win. What does that mean? You sleep with somebody? I mean, I guess that would be hard.
Maybe which performance was the most arduous, or which did
oh,
you...
Oh, arduous.
Maybe?
Okay.
I'll be a translator here.
Thank you. It was definitely West Side Story. It was really, really hard. I hadn't danced for a bunch of years when I auditioned for it. And I thought I would probably lose the part because I passed the audition for singing. I passed the audition for acting. But I hadn't danced at that time for about 15 years. You know, it's like suddenly doing 12 sets of tennis in one afternoon. It's really not possible.
We got a request from your audience here. By the way, somebody says you were wonderful at the Napa Opera House. I'm glad to see your earrings aren't falling off.
Raise your hand. Who are you? Hi. I slap them around a lot afterwards.
I don't know. Somebody says, will you sing a few verses of your favorite song from West Side Story?
Are you serious? I'll tell you what I will do. America, you keep forgetting. Everyone forgets. It's a call and response song, right? Can't do America. But let me do a little piece of a song that I love that I do in my act, which is a song that is about... In fact, I sang this for Sonia Sotomayor. And by the way, I did her audiobook. In case you didn't know, which obviously you didn't. I did her audiobook. It's about the yearning for home when you come from another country. And it says, more or less, I'll give you a very rough translation. It's, oh, my beloved land, do not think for one moment that I have forgotten you, because I cannot get you out of my heart, no matter how hard I try. You are the ocean within me. I'm doing it in Spanish. You are all of the oceans of my youth. And the saddest part is that as much as I love you, I can never really have you back again. Okay, here we go. And if I find a key that's too high, well, you'll have to just put up with some cracked voices, because I have laryngitis. Mis recuerdos van conmigo. Cuando quiero y sin querer, que no piensen que me olvido de mi tierra alguna vez, y es el mar que llevo dentro, aquel mar de mi niñez. Que hoy aún me está doliendo, como duele lo que quieres y no lo puedes tener. Como duele lo que quieres y no lo puedes tener. And this is better than I sang on Sunday, so you can imagine what that was like.
Qué graciosa, qué hermosa, muy gracias. By the way, what singers do you most admire, and what actresses do you most admire, or actors?
I just love singers.
You mentioned Ann Miller, and that's dancing always.
Well, that's different, but I just love singers who act the words, and there aren't that many around. You know, there is someone like Bernadette Peters, who performs the meaning of the words. That's what I do. And I probably don't have the greatest voice in the world, but it's true. And I have good pitch. And sometimes I can even make it sound sweet. But it's hardly Barbara Streisand. But what's, I think, different about me than other singers is that I sing with my heart and my soul. So I love Streisand, too, if she isn't yelling a lot. She tends to yell. And it's too bad, because she's gorgeous. She's fabulous. I love Bernadette. I like Patti LuPone. Those are the people I love. I love, I'm trying to remember a name, but I can't, so screw it.
It's not the woman Jean with the laryngitis, is it? What about actors?
Actors. I love...
You mentioned Sophia Loren before, so...
I don't love her as an actress.
No, all right.
No, I love Cate Blanchett. She's astonishing.
Did you see Blue Jasmine?
I did. Yeah. I did. It's he was doing, wasn't he? Streetcar Named Desire, wasn't he? I mean, come on. He was doing that. And she had played Blanche DuBois a few years ago in New York. When she did Streetcar Named Desire. So she knows that role really, really well. The thing is that the casting was superb. Everyone in that movie was absolutely fabulous. Bobby Cannavale, Alec Baldwin, everybody was... Sally Hawkins, who I understand is English, who played her sister? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, she's astonishing.
You mentioned Blanche DuBois. I think about Vivian Leigh, of course, but I remember interviewing one of my first, quote, celebrity actor interviews was Anne Margaret, and she had just done a performance of Streetcar and had played Blanche and had gone so deep into the character that she thought she was really going to lose her mind. Has anything like that ever happened to you? No. Okay.
I'm much too much in touch with myself. I mean, that's not a good thing.
No.
I don't think you need to let yourself go to that extent, really. Anne Margaret is a very fragile person. She's very delicate. She's very tender. A very sweet person as well. And I think I can see where a role like that would get to her. But you shouldn't allow that to happen.
Well, you played Amanda Wingfield at the Berkeley Repertory Theater.
I did, and I loved it. I just loved playing Amanda Wingfield. Because you know why I loved it so much, too, aside from the fact that it's a great part, the Glass Menagerie? It's doing something that people don't expect you to be able to do. And I remember I got some super-duper wonderful reviews for my depiction of Amanda. And I think I brought something to her that rarely happens with actresses. I don't know why. One of Tennessee Williams' greatest gifts is that he can find the comedy and the humor in people's dreadful lives. And she's funny. She's a monster, and she is tragic. She's all of those. That's what makes Tennessee Williams so astonishing.
It was a wonderful performance. I mean, you were believable.
Oh, you saw it, didn't you? Yeah.
Entirely
wasn't
believable as a Southern woman. Just like you're believable as Fran Drescher's mother now. I mean, sounding Jewish, really, in Eastern.
Well, it's not just Jewish, darling. It's it's very Queens. It's very Queens Jewish. And one day when I was rehearsing with her, and, you know, I kind of do a little bit of huh. And she stopped the rehearsal and she said, Rita, where'd you learn to do that? And I said, well, aside from being married to one of you people, I said, all I have to do is listen to you all the time. I love accents. Accents are fun.
A great ear. What was Natalie Wood like, and any thoughts about her death?
Natalie Wood was, in my view, hard to work with because she was, I think she felt very uncomfortable with all of us. She didn't want to do it originally, West Side Story, and they just kept making offers that she couldn't refuse, and they finally made one that she couldn't refuse. And then I have a feeling that she was a little bit sorry. I think she felt out of her element. And you know, it could have been so much easier for her had she done this. This is what's so interesting about actors who have been acting since they're little kids. They don't know how very often to connect with other people because they've spent their lives, their young lives, being adored. Oh, Natalie, you're so pretty. Oh, Natalie, look at that darling dress. Would you like some coffee? Would you like some tea? Let me get you this. Let me get you that. And as a result, I feel they don't know how to connect to other people. They're always being served. And all she had to do to make friends with all of us, because I was very uncomfortable with her. And I have to tell you right now, she was never rude. She was never anything bad. She just wasn't there for us. And all she had to do, in my view, is to say one day to us on a Friday, why don't you all come to my house on Sunday? We'll sit by the pool and get drunk and have hot dogs and you know, burgers and stuff like that, and we'll have some fun. That's all she had to do, but she didn't know that. She didn't know how to do that. So we never really became close to her. And it's a shame. And I felt bad for her when I understood that finally.
And a reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program. Our guest is star of stage and screen and now author Rita Moreno. And you can also find a video of this on this Commonwealth Club and other Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. Well, here's a question that takes a good deal of chutzpah to ask. It begins with, you look absolutely fabulous. Have you had any plastic surgery? And if so, who is your doctor?
That is a great question, actually, because if I had had it, I'm not going to tell you. What am I, Joan Rivers? The answer is no, I have not. I have terrific genes. And I mean, look at my neck. If you, you know, this is a really bad job if somebody did a job on me, right? No, I have really good Caribbean skin, no question. I'm very proud of it, but no, no, and no.
Another somewhat bold question. You stated in an interview that Elvis Presley was not a good lover. Of all your leading men, who really knocked your socks off?
I don't want to sound too Jewish, but who then? Marlon.
Yeah.
Oh, he was an astonishing lover, person, intellect, all kinds of things.
But what do you think, you know, I mentioned to you, we have a mutual friend name that many of you know, Joyce Carol Oates, who said, who actually sent me an article that she wrote about Brando, and she said he was a stone-cold misogynist. I mean, she really didn't mince her words about him at all.
So oh, did you find the article? Because you said you would send it to me.
I'm still looking for it. I'll find
okay.
it for you. But, I mean, that's a strong word to use.
He was. But, you know, it's what I said earlier. I don't want to repeat myself again, but you've got this young girl who's, oh, by the way, I was always very young for my age anyway. And I met Marlon when I was about, I think I was about 22, for Pete's sake. And a romantic, and you see this god. I mean, the man did look like a Roman coin, that profile. Please. So, no, I don't doubt it. He was terrible. He was also terrific.
Knocked your socks off.
Knocked my socks off. He was, I have to tell you, he was the funniest man I've ever met. He had just an incredible sense of humor, and he could imitate anybody. So we laughed, and to me it's always been important that I can be with a man who makes me laugh. I don't know why. To me, laughter, which is why I also love Jewish men, because here's my crazy take on Jewish men. It's not crazy, actually. Very often they have great senses of humor. The way I suppose a lot of black men do, too, because they've been through so much. And they know how to defend themselves in a bad situation. They use their humor. And that, to me, has always become sexy because it means they can take care of me. They're sort of in charge in their own very perverse way. And for a man to be in charge to me is very sexy because it means he'll always look after me. Now, I thought about Marlon, too. He was a terrible guy with women, but that's how I saw him until I couldn't see him that way
Protectiveness
anymore.
Protectiveness and paternal quality.
I feel very protected. Yeah. I married a Jewish man, a nice Jewish doctor, which is redundant.
In fact, you know the joke about when do Jewish people consider fetuses to be viable? After med school? Rita.
Yes?
You have received awards in every genre. Have you ever had a flop, and how did you handle it? And we all love you. But they want to know about flops.
I've had nothing but flops. You've got to read my book. Now you really have to buy it. You really have to read my book because you read it, James. Yes. I've had plenty of flops. And in every field, in TV, in a theater, in any venture that I took upon myself, and a great deal of it had to do with being Hispanic. And not being allowed, and I use the word knowing what I'm saying, allowed to do other roles for so many, many years. So my life was filled with flops.
Do you?
Sure.
I remember Nora Ephron once saying that you remember the flops more. Do you?
Of course you do. You always remember the bad criticisms too more. Mm-hmm. It just hurts. And you know, I hear a lot of people in my business say I don't read the reviews, and well, I do. Because if it's good, it's going to be really great. And that's important to me. I still need that kind of, I'm an actress. And I'm, with all that that implies, which means that I'm still very vulnerable. I know I give an impression of being because of my sense of humor and my ability to get up and dust myself off. I give an impression of being very strong. Actually, I am strong. But at the same time, I am very vulnerable. And, you know, people look at me now at 81 and say, well, God, I couldn't be that way. She's so strong. Hey, you're looking at the result of 81 years worth of labor and refining and fixing. That's what I tell Latina women a lot. And I do it, say it very often, because they just think, oh, well, you know, she's perfect. That's how they see me very often. And it's anything but that.
Still a work in progress, huh?
Always. Always. I mean, I cry. I get so nervous on opening nights. You have no idea. Cold, clammy hands. My knees literally shake. Why does this happen to me? I figured it out. Because I want to be perfect, and I know I'm not going to be. I mean, how unfair can you be to yourself? That's horribly unfair.
I'm, you know, struck by, I know you've developed kind of a friendship with Sonia Sotomayor and Justice on the Supreme Court. You come from similar backgrounds, and she also expressed in her autobiography, and expressed actually on the air in an interview with me, this sense of trying to strive for perfection and always feeling somehow that it's out of reach and that she was limited and all of those kinds of things. And how much of this really do you think has to do with your ethnicity and your
poor
background?
It has almost everything to do with the ethnicity. Because I also had, as a role model, I had my mother, who on the one hand was amazing. I mean, she came to this country not knowing English. She brought me here, all of that. But also, I got the impression from her that I had to be nice, always. That I had to be especially compliant to men. And that has stayed with me. You know, it's very easy to say, yeah, well, I was in therapy, which I was for a number of years, and I think it helped me enormously. More than anything, it helped me to develop a third ear as to what was genuine and what was that persona that I kept trying to find that really didn't exist. So I think it has a great deal to do with that. And I think when it happens to people like ourselves, like Sonia and myself, we happen to be very sensitive people to begin with. You're born that way. My daughter's like that. When she was a tiny little baby, I'll never forget it. And I thought, oh my God, it's in the genes. She found a safety pin on the floor. She couldn't even crawl yet. She was sitting on the floor, and she had a safety pin in her hand. And in the calmest way I could, I said to her, oh, no, honey, you don't want to play with that. But she reacted so out of proportion to my tone of voice. That's the DNA also.
Mm-hmm. So it's gone to the next generation.
Oh, yeah.
What about your grandchildren?
They are my little beacons of light. Mm-hmm. I adore them with all my heart. I had such a bad family experience in my life that Fernanda, my daughter, and the two boys are the air I breathe. And the reason I don't accept certain jobs now is because I don't want to be away. I probably will never get to do my show in New York, though I desperately want to, because if it means having to be there for 6 months, I can't be away from them. I'm 81 now. I don't know. You know, I'm in the third act of my life now. I have no idea what part of the third act this is.
Well, thank heavens for Fernanda, because she wound up in Oakland, and that's why you're here, really, isn't it?
That's why I'm here.
Yeah. Another member of the audience says, Miss Moreno, the last time I heard you talk, after your talk, you led your audience on a run around the town. I've always wondered, did you do this after every talk, and will you be doing so after tonight's event?
I took people on a run around the town. I don't even remember that. Now, for one thing, I have a broken toe, number one. Number two, I have crappy knees. And I wouldn't do it if you paid me. So the answer is, no, I'll have a drink with you.
With the August 28th Martin Luther King Jr. I've Got a Dream 50th anniversary speech date, will you tell us about your being there? This is from someone who knows you, I believe. Anyway, you're doing
I was at that event. I was sitting no closer than, no farther than about 10 to 15 feet away on the Lincoln Monument in front of Dr. King. I saw every pop of sweat that came out on his upper lip. It was a hugely hot, hot day. We were just dying from the heat. I saw him no more than 10 or 15 feet away, veer away from the text and start talking about, I had a dream. I have a dream. I was there, and I was there because Harry Belafonte wanted to be sure that the Hollywood contingent, the ones who were serious about all of this, were represented with Dr. Martin Luther King. And I believe he spoke to him about that. And I was one of the ones. I was there sitting next to all of them. It was just astonishing. It's astonishing. In fact, I got interviewed on the phone the other day by someone who's doing a story on that event. And it's coming out tomorrow in People magazine. I don't even know if I'll be quoted, but that's where I met James Foreman, and I had this wonderful little love affair with the young man who was in charge of SNCC, S-N-C-C. Do you remember SNCC? Anybody remember SNCC? I get goosebumps when I talk about it even now. It was astonishing. To look in back of me to the reflecting pool back there with thousands and thousands of people wearing the uniform of that particular event, which was a denim coverall. Remember the coveralls? And straw hats. And seeing all of these people literally, literally just jammed together was... it's hard to find the words. But I knew that something special was happening that day. And that we would never, this country would never... I got goosebumps... would never ever be the same again. And it wasn't.
You want to talk a little bit about your politics? Because when you mentioned Belafonte, I can remember, actually I did a show with him live, radio show from Tahoe back in the days when I was working at ABC. And he was fiery. I mean, he was so angry about Bush 1. And going into a rhetoric that was nothing short of being invective-filled. And where do you place yourself? I mean, do you see yourself as radical, liberal, moderate? How do you see yourself?
You know, it's not something I even bother thinking about. I am what I am. Sometimes I'm radical. Sometimes I'm liberal. Rarely am I... I don't think I'm conservative at all. I don't think, it's just not in my DNA. But... I don't care to even categorize myself because I don't even know what all of that means. Sometimes you suddenly say, well, you know, he has a point. And, you know, what does that then make me? I don't know. And
you like President Obama?
Very much.
Yeah.
I worked really, really hard for him along with, of course, I don't want to seem like it was all me. I worked really hard for him along with thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. One of my greatest experiences was meeting him when he gave me the Medal of Merit, which was about, what, 3-4 years ago. And I rehearsed all morning because he said, you know, he's going to. And but at that point, I've already gotten medals from the other presidents. I really have. And so they said, you know, he's going to, you're going to come up. This was the Gold Room, where, in fact, I did America from West Side Story when the Clintons became when he became president, and it was the first dinner he had for the governors, all of the Democratic governors, and that's the same Gold Room. Anyway, they said, you know, he's going to ask you to come up, Obama, and he'll shake your hand, and you'll bow your head, and you know, then you'll go back to your seat. So I rehearsed all morning, knowing me, because I'm so passionate. And I got there, and he'd already done a number of fabulous people, including Michael Tilson Thomas. And I went up there, ready to do my dignified best, and I grabbed him. I just went, and his wife was right there, and I just went, can't be helped. And we talked, and everybody kept saying, what did you say to him? You were talking. And I said, well, we have a mutual friend in common, and Jeffrey Bleich. And he said, yes, I just made him the ambassador to Australia. I said, I know. So it was just an amazing experience. He's terrific. What God, he's a sexy guy. Dazzling smile. Dazzling smile. Doesn't mean I had not been disappointed, but he's had a rather hard job.
Someone would like your impressions about the status of theater here in the Bay Area.
Well, I haven't been here enough to really report on that. I'm so glad we have the Aurora. That I know.
But you're very keen on Tony Taccone. You worked with him.
Absolutely.
To put it mildly, yeah.
Absolutely. I will do anything. I'm a
theater.
Slut for nonprofit theater. Mm-hmm. I mean that. I will do anything I can to help nonprofit theater.
And someone wants to know what your most embarrassing moment in a performance while filming while at a star-studded event.
I didn't have one, but I had one in a pool once when I was wearing falsies and I was under the water and I looked up. And there was this little rubber breast floating above my head. I think I was 16. It was horrible. Surprised you, huh?
What was it like playing opposite Natalie Wood, pretending to be Puerto Rican? That is, Natalie Wood pretending to be Puerto Rican.
Well, it was difficult. Yeah. It was really difficult. And, hey, you do the best you can. It isn't just that problem that arises when you're working with an actor whose work you don't particularly care for or an actor who's uncomfortable. It's always the same. And you have to do your job and just, you know, she thought I was great in this. She told me so one day, and it made me feel very good.
But, did you get to know Bernstein at all?
He never showed up.
Never showed up?
None of them showed up. No. I saw him once in a restaurant after the film came out, huge success, and I introduced myself to him, and he was very cool. Hmm. Sorry, sad to say. Yeah. Actually, he was with a guy. That's what it was. He was with a guy at dinner, and I think at that time...
He's in the closet then, probably.
Yes, and I think, thinking back now, I think that's why he was cool. He didn't want anybody in our business to see that.
What's one piece of advice you would give an aspiring star?
Education, education, education. You cannot have a guarantee that you're going to be a star, let alone that you're going to work as an actor. Work as an actor, and you'd better have obtained some kind of skill so that you don't end up washing dishes, so that you get a skill that pays well, so that you can then pay for your acting classes and pay your rent and buy your clothing and feed yourself. That's first.
Don't quit your day job.
No, not at all.
Well, when we first met, actually we met on the phone, you called me and wanted a tape of an interview I did with Jerome Kagan, who is a Harvard child psychiatrist, and you have a lot of rather diverse interests, to put it mildly. I mean, a lot of books that you're reading, I happened to notice last time I was at your home, and so you are self-educated to a great degree and remain and continue to be self-educated. Do you have anything you'd
recommend? Indeed, I am. I quit school in the first year of high.
What kind of books now are you reading? What do you?
I love William Kennedy. I just love him. I think he's just brilliant, and I love Amy Tan, who also happens to be a friend. And oh God, The Policeman's
Michael Chabon.
Oh, yeah. Knocks me
Yiddish
out.
Policeman's.
Knocks me out. Yeah, that's what I like.
And what about work that you still love to do? I mean, what's in your head? What's in your consciousness about performing that's up ahead or might be up ahead? I mean, well, I remember you did the Plush Room, you've done Napa, you've done a lot
I want to come back to nightclubs and maybe do Feinstein's again. It's really fun. I was reminded of it when I did my act at the Napa Opera House Sunday. It's so much fun. I'm very comfortable with people. I have no shyness about people. And, even with my bad voice, I just thought, well, you know, they'll put up with it, they'll leave. I don't care.
Well, what about the one-woman show, though? I mean, I know it.
I
a lot of people
to,
feel it should be on Broadway. Or,
I know. I very much want to do, we need to refine it, though, the Life Without Makeup, my play about my life, which has inspired the book. So there's that also. And, you know, we'll see. I'm loving every moment. I got a new agent who is just thrilled to be with me, which is nice for a change. And I'm gung-ho. I'm the Energizer Bunny.
You still are indefatigable in terms of your vitality, and that is plainly clear to everybody here this evening. What do you want them to know about your book? A lot of people are going to maybe take the opportunity to buy your book.
I think I really said what I need to say about it, which is that that it's a story about the journey that this young woman is set on, a person who doesn't want to be who she is. That's a tough one. And it took a very, very long time for me to accept who I am. So there's that. And then, you know, what's very interesting about my book, I think, for civilians who are not in show business, is the old Hollywood, which no longer exists. So there's some wonderful stories there, some terribly sad ones. The Ann Miller one, I think, is hilarious. Because, by the way, there's lots more to that one. I just told you the one with the bad words because it was so funny. But there's all kinds of things there that you won't expect. Most people don't, because they still see this 81-year-old woman who's seemingly in charge. And then you read the book and you say, oh, I had no idea. So that's what they'll get.
You want to say something about being 81?
You know what? I love it. I wake up humming. I'm in the prime of my life. I never felt so wonderful ever. This is it. And we have 4 seconds left.
No, that's minutes. That's minutes.
Oh, 4 minutes?
Yeah.
Oh,
in
I thought
fact,
it was
I've
seconds.
I've got the sign that says last question.
I was trying to cut down my answers because, oh, my God, we only have 4 seconds left.
Unfortunately, we reached the point in the program where I have to ask you a last question. And here it is. I was thinking, I had some guesses about this, but I'm just going to ask you point blank. You have to put something in a space capsule of your work. What would it be?
Well, you can't put love in a space capsule, can you? Because that's what I would do. I'm a fierce lover. I love with ferocity and enormous profundity and passion. And
You're a passionate woman, but aside from that, I mean, I'm talking about your work now, which is how
my
a lot of passion
work.
No, that can't be in the space capsule. It's got to be your love.
Yeah, because that's what means the most to me. I mean, you know, I
Yeah, can I say how much you love that Muppet movie, that Muppet appearance that you...
Oh, yeah, I love that. Okay, I'll put that in there.
Yeah, I thought you might want to.
It's hilarious. You'll have to tune in. It's not called tuning in. What is it when you use the web? When you log in? Is that what it's called? I live in another era. But I did one of the most hilarious pieces with the Muppet, the drummer. The Muppet drummer. And I'm singing Fever. And you can find it on YouTube. You will love it. And that I know that's why I got one of my Emmys for that one. And I'm trying to be real sexy. You'll never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. That when you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever, and he just goes ba da ba da ba bum 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 bum. And I just turn around and look at him. When you kiss me, fever ba da ba da ba da. It is so funny. Finally, at the end of the number, I just walk up to him slowly, and I take 2 cymbals and smash his little head. And when I take the cymbals away from his head, he says, oh, not my kind of woman. I can't see that. I still laugh, and it's, what is that, 15 years old now or something like that? I still laugh so hard. The children love it. My grandchildren adore it. Yeah, I'll put that in the capsule.
Yeah. Because you love comedy and you love to bring humor, and you do it so well, as you do everything so well. Amazing performer, a memorable evening, and our thanks to Rita Moreno, a legendary performer, author of a new book, Rita Moreno, a memoir. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I want to remind everyone that copies of Rita Moreno's memoir are on sale in the lobby, and she will graciously be pleased to sign them outside the room immediately following the program. Also appreciate...
Only if somebody gives me a glass of wine.
Also appreciate your allowing her to get to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Michael Krasny of KQED Forum, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.